Step, Georgia is a town of about 300. In 1938, no one was prospering, and the local school teacher had just passed away. Enter the new teacher, a worldly young woman with a lot of energy, big ideas, and a complete 10-volume set of the Tales of the Arabian Nights. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. That is the setup for the new novel, The Caliphs of Baghdad, Georgia, by Iowan novelist Mary Helen Stefaniak. In the next hour, I'll talk with her about the world she created and upended in the book. We'll also talk about the writing process, Southern culture, segregation, camels, and, of course, the 1001 Arabian Nights. Please join our conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning, I'm Charity Nebbe. Today we are traveling into the Deep South, into a world created by my guest Mary Helen Stefaniak. Mary Helen teaches at Creighton University, and she splits her time between Omaha and Iowa City. She's just released her latest novel. It's called The Caliphs of Baghdad, Georgia. Hello, Mary Helen.
Hi, Charity.
How are you today?
I'm fine today. Delighted to be here in Des Moines.
Well, thank you so much for being here with us. Can you tell us a little bit about this town you've created, Three Step, Georgia, to set the scene for us?
Well, Three Step, Georgia is a very small place that in 1938 would be even more than today a backwater. It's in the central part of Georgia, in middle Georgia, which is, in fact, the part of Georgia that my mother is from. It's not anywhere near Savannah or Atlanta. It's kind of quite close to Milledgeville, Georgia.
And it's very small.
It's
town of 300?
It's very small. Yes, it is. It's a town of just 300, although in the course of the book they managed to come up with a sign that sets their population at 1001.
So when the book begins, it's when a new teacher comes to town. There is a one-room schoolhouse in town, and the teacher that had been there for many, many years has passed away. This is in the depths of the Depression. It's 1938. Well, I guess it's toward the tail end of the Depression, but Three Step, Georgia is still right in there in the depths.
It is. And in fact, in 1938, there was a kind of a second dip. Things that were looking better across the country, but 1937-38, there was a kind of a scare that the WPA and other New Deal things weren't working, and that the country was sliding down again. And fortunately, it picked up. But it was a difficult time.
And somebody in your book remarks at some point, well, Georgia's always a few steps behind anyway, so they felt like they were lagging in any kind of recovery that was going on.
Right. Well, the socioeconomic class that is best represented in Three Step is one of farmers, small farmers, and tenant farmers and people who have very small businesses, so they wouldn't be booming really at any time, I suppose.
Right. So a new teacher comes to town, and she is sent by the WPA. Tell me about Miss Spivey.
Well, I actually thought I might read the moment of Miss Spivey's arrival, which actually tells you quite a bit about her.
Okay.
All right. So this is from the very beginning of the book. Miss Grace Spivey arrived in Three Step, Georgia, in August of 1938. She stepped off the train wearing a pair of thick-soled boots suitable for hiking, a navy blue dress, and a little white tam that rode the waves of her red hair at a gravity-defying angle. August was a hellish month to step off the train in Georgia, although it was nothing, she said, compared to the 119 degrees that greeted her when she got off the boat one time in a place she called El Basra. I believe her remark irritated some of the people gathered to welcome her on the burned grass alongside the tracks. When folks are sweating through their shorts, they don't like to hear that this is nothing compared to someplace else. Irritated or not, the majority of those present were inclined to see the arrival of the new school teacher in a positive light. Hard times were still upon us in 1938, but like my mama said, we weren't no poorer than we'd ever been, and the citizens of Three Step were in the mood for a little excitement. Miss Spivey looked like just the right person to give it to them. She was, by almost anyone's standards, a woman of the world. She'd gone to boarding school since she was 6 years old. She'd studied French in Paris and drama in London. And during what she called a fruitful intermission in her formal education, she had traveled extensively in the Near East and Africa with a friend of her grandmother's, one Janet Miller, who was a medical doctor from Nashville, Tennessee. After her travels with Dr. Miller, Miss Spivey continued her education by attending Barnard College in New York City. She told us that at school the first day. When my little brother Ralford asked what did she study at Barnard College, Miss Spivey explained that Barnard, which she wrote on the blackboard, was the sister school of Columbia University, of which, she expected, we all had heard. It was there, she told us, in the midst of trying to find her true mission in life, that she wandered one afternoon into a lecture by the famous John Dewey, who was talking about his famous book, Democracy and Education. Professor Dewey was in his 70s by then, Miss Spivey said, but he still liked to chat with students after a lecture, especially female students, she added, sometimes over coffee, and see in their eyes the fire his words could kindle. It was after this lecture and subsequent coffee that Miss Spivey had marched to the teacher's college and signed up all aflame. 2 years later, she told a cheery, blue-suited woman from the WPA that she wanted to bring democracy and education to the poorest, darkest, most remote, and forgotten corner of America. They sent her to Three Step, Georgia.
Mary Helen Stefaniak reading from her new novel, The Caliphs of Baghdad, Georgia. And that was the moment when the new school teacher came to town into the deepest, darkest corner of America, as her description is. And tell us a little bit about the voice, the narrator of the novel, because it's clearly, you can tell already from that segment, told in the voice of a young woman.
Yes, the narrator is 11 years old. She's 11-year-old Gladys Califf, a student in Miss Spivey's school, and she's pretty enamored and impressed with Miss Spivey right from the start.
I love Gladys. I mean, she's just a wonderful girl. She's so intelligent and so open to new experiences. Did you choose to have an 11-year-old narrator for any specific reason?
Well, I think I knew I wanted to have a child narrator from the start because I wanted it to be somebody who was a student, you know, in her school. There's another student, both Miss Spivey's and Gladys's nemesis, Mavis Davis, a seventh grader, a couple of years older than Gladys, who kind of takes the other side of issues. But I knew that I needed to have that kind of inside voice. Then Gladys is, I mean, all of the caliphs, of course, Gladys is the family gives the title to the book, so they are pretty important. And they're modeled, as some of them, Gladys in particular, and her brother Force, and her parents, on relatives of mine, really, on my mother's family. So Gladys is sort of a version of my mother combined with some other people.
I also love the fact that since she's 11 years old, and she is, as I mentioned, a very bright young woman, but she's not entirely reliable as a narrator. Was that useful to you in writing the book, that you had someone who didn't necessarily understand everything that was going on?
Oh, that's always the best kind of narrator. You want to have a clueless narrator who's sort of, you know, making their way through the situation and trying to figure it out as they go along, because that's the position the reader's in as well.
Tell me a little bit about the Califf family. And Gladys, is she the fourth child in the Califf family? Yes, the fourth child, right?
Well, she's the second youngest. I'd have to go
okay.
in the other direction. So The caliphs, as we meet them here, consist of, we'll start with the youngest, Ralford, the youngest, who's 9 years old and who is an important character in the book. And I have to say that Ralford is, in fact, the name of one of my great uncles. So I borrowed that unusual name, which turns out to be important in lots of ways in the book, from a real great uncle. And then there's Gladys, who's 11. And then the next in line is Force Caliph, who's 17, and he does not go to school here in Three Step. He goes to school at the Military Academy, or which is modeled on Georgia Military College, which really is in Milledgeville, about 18 miles away. Then there is also a brother, Ebenezer, whom we don't see a great deal of, who's the next older brother. And then the oldest I forgot about
Ildred.
Ildred. Oh, yes. How could I forget Ildred? Ildred comes between Force and Ebenezer, and she's the one who was supposed to be named Mildred, but when she was born, the sight of her, as Gladys says, shook Mama some, and the M on the birth certificate turned out to be a big old blob of ink. So that all that was left was Ildred, and Mama said that was exactly right because she was ill and filled with dread the whole time she was expecting that child. And Ildred has one short arm, or she only has her right arm is incomplete, ends at about above the elbow. So that was what shook Mama there. And Ildred's a really important and one of my favorite characters in the book, and she too is based on one of my mother's aunts. But her name was not Ildred. And then we have Ebenezer, who has a traveling stove repair business. I mean, the stoves don't travel. Ebenezer does. And he has that business with his brother-in-law, Ed. And Ed is the husband of the oldest of the Caliph children, who happens to be exactly the same age as Miss Spivey, which is 29. May is already married to Ed and has 5 children of her own as the story begins.
You mentioned Ildred's name, and I love the piece in the book where Gladys is explaining where all of her siblings' names come from to Miss Spivey. So can you fill us in a little bit? Because you mentioned Ralph Ford, which is her younger brother, and
right.
That's wonderful that that's a real name that you borrowed. Was the real Ralph Ford named after someone whose name was Ralph Ford?
Yeah, well, yes, spelled just as it is in the book, which is Ralph, R-A-L-P-H, and then O-R-D. The real uncle, my real great uncle, Ralford, was not, and that's how you'd say it. You wouldn't say, these are mid-Georgians, they would say Ralford. You wouldn't exactly be able to know if they were saying Ralph Ford or Rutherford, which actually for years I thought his name was Rutherford. And then it turned out, no, his name is Ralford. He and Ebenezer and Gladys have real caliph names, I guess, from my mother's family.
Well, we'll talk more about the book and about the names in just a moment. My guest today is Mary Helen Stefaniak. She's the author of The Caliphs of Baghdad, Georgia. You're listening to The Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. My guest today is Mary Helen Stefaniak. She is an author who lives in Iowa City, and she also teaches at Creighton University, so she splits her time between Omaha and Iowa City. And her latest novel is called The Caliphs of Baghdad, Georgia. And Mary Helen, before we got to the break, we were talking about the Caliph family, which is at the center of this story, and some of their unusual names. And we talked about Ralford, who is named after a man named Ralph Ford. And there's the older brother Force, who is in many ways the hero of the tale. He's a movie star, good looks. Everyone loves Force. Where did his name come from?
You want me to tell that story?
I do.
Okay. Mama had some trouble delivering Force. It seems that he was situated wrong, and so Force is the only one of the caliphs to be born in hospital in Savannah. And, as it turned out, In the end, he decided not to come out at all. And as Gladys says, they had to grab his tiny hips and pull him into the world. And Mama had apparently made some kind of vow about what she would name the baby if she and the baby came through it alive. And she was might have regretted that vow, but she was afraid not to keep it. And so Force ends up named for the instrument Forceps that pulled him out. And so it's a good thing that they shorten the name to Force. And of course, that's kind of a surprise to Miss Spivey to hear that that's where his name came from. And he is such a sort of force, as you said, you know, kind of a force of nature. He's just kind of this beautiful, loving person, friendly, enjoys everybody, and everybody enjoys him. So the shortened form of it worked pretty well. For him.
And Gladys, the narrator, is named Gladys because her mama was so glad to see her.
That's right. I was Gladys because, in my mama's own words, I was so glad to see you, sugar, after all the trouble she had with Force and Ildred. Yeah, so.
That's beautiful. This novel takes place, as we've talked about, in the Deep South. And this is something in your own family history. You grew up in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, but in a biography that you wrote about yourself, you said you grew up in a bicultural household.
Yeah.
Explain that to me.
Well, that's because my father was born actually to an immigrant family in Milwaukee, and my mother was born in Gordon, Georgia, and was raised there, not in Gordon, but in central Georgia. Gordon is also in the middle of Georgia, in the same area where my fictional town of Three Step is located. So when I was a child, teen years, I didn't know you could go on a vacation that wasn't a trip to Georgia. I thought Georgia and vacation were synonyms because we went to Georgia every year and visited the relatives. So I really had an opportunity and we mostly stayed in Macon and Milledgeville and a little town named Haddock, which is also in this central part of Georgia. So I kind of grew up knowing things like, you can't put, it's too late to put the sugar in your iced tea after it's already got ice in it. Now, anybody south of the Mason-Dixon line could tell you that it's a futile effort because it won't dissolve, you know. And so there are all sorts of little things like that made me realize, really, as a child, that I had another whole background of the way people talked, the things they ate, and the attitudes they had, some of which were not the ideal, but there was it really was another culture from the kind of European Milwaukee culture.
Do you think that since you grew up in the North, since you grew up in Milwaukee, did that give you a special perspective when you visited Georgia to be able to really observe what was going on?
Yes, and I feel as though it kind of gave me a good perspective on both places, on my own hometown of Milwaukee and on Georgia, on Macon. I can, in fact, I hesitate to admit that I'm old enough to remember, I was very young at the time, going into the Woolworths or the dime store in downtown Macon to get an ice cream while my mom was shopping, to get an ice cream with my sister. And there was no one sitting at the soda fountain counter. And we had this awareness that we knew that you were supposed to sit in a certain one end or the other. We weren't sure where to sit. So that was kind of those sorts of things were unsettling and confusing, I should say. But then, you know, I would come back to Milwaukee, and whereas in Georgia, because my relatives, or many of them, my Aunt Sissy, for example, lived in this tiny town of Haddock, Georgia. They lived in small places. They really lived a little tiny town like that is just too small to be segregated. You know, people, you have neighbors, black and white. And whereas in Milwaukee, in the early 1960s, the segregation was de facto segregation. It wasn't by law; it was by custom. Was so complete that I don't think I ever spoke with a black person until I went to high school. So, you know, I would see that differently. You know, I'd notice that because when I would go to Georgia, well, there were African Americans and everywhere to be seen.
I think this is a nice time to introduce another hero, really, another main character in your book. And I know that you had selected a reading where we meet Theo Boykin. So Can you share that with us?
Sure, I'd love to. And at this point, Theo has been asked by Miss Spivey to help with the Halloween party. She's planning a Halloween party and they want to have a haunted house. And Theo is known for his cleverness in constructing such things. Theo Boykin was the smartest person in Piedmont County, and everybody knew it. Whether folks liked it or not was another matter. Theo, who was about the same age as Force, could do sums in his head better than Mrs. Bibbins' adding machine at the store, and he could read you anything he laid his hands on, even if he never saw it before in his life, without ever stumbling over a single word. One 4th of July, when the parade marshal of Piedmont County waited till the last minute to line up his post-parade program, he couldn't find but one person in Claytonville, Brennan, and Three Step combined who knew all the words to the Declaration of Independence. Theo was 10 or 11 at the time. You'd better believe a murmur went through the audience when he stepped up to the podium on the courthouse lawn in Claytonville that day. But by the time he got to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, he had the whole audience in the palm of his hand. I'm told they applauded louder and longer for Theophilus Boykin than they had for the tap dancers or the Land of Liberty tableau. He could draw, too. Miss Templeton, his teacher at the colored school out in the country, said one time that Theo was a Renaissance man, by which she meant he could do anything he put his mind to. This led to Miss Spivey calling him Signor da Vinci later on when he was drawing up plans for the Baghdad Bazaar, beautiful sketches with numbers and arrows to show what went where. None of us knew who Signor da Vinci was until we had a lesson at school on him and Michelangelo that included the opportunity to lie on your back and paint whatever you wanted on the underside of your desk for as long as your arm could stand it.
Theo Boykin, you mentioned, is about the same age as Force, and the Boykins are neighbors of the Califs, and there are certainly race relation problems in the town of Three Step, Georgia. But can you describe the relationship between the two families for me?
Well, they're not only neighbors, but friends. And Mrs. Boykin, Theo's mother, is a good friend of Daisy Califf, the Califf children's mother. And Theo has grown up with Force and Ildred as kind of his closest friends and colleagues in getting into things as they do. They're all kind of he's kind of the leader of their interest in mechanical things and building. For example, they build an electrical generator once at one point that later comes in very handy when the Baghdad Bazaar needs to have some electrical lighting. But they really are neighbors, and there are reasons for that that go back into their history that make them particularly close. But even as close as they are, when Miss Spivey at one point mentions to Gladys after Theo helps with the Baghdad, not with the Baghdad Bazaar, with the Halloween haunted house, which is a huge success. And Miss Spivey says, well, what could we do for your friend Theo? And hearing that, Gladys is a little taken aback by the word friend, that she wouldn't have called Theo her friend, even though, you know, he obviously was.
It's interesting that you mentioned that, because the relationship between the two families is very close. But in your creation, although the parents of the Califs have clearly explored and thought out race relations. They love Theo's family, regardless of their color. It doesn't seem like that's something that was ever talked about within their home.
What, race relations?
Right.
I think you're right about that. And I think in part it's because in order to be friends as close as they are, and again, because of their history, there are things that probably I can't exactly explain, but without giving away a little too much, but they are very close. And when you're close to people, I don't think you pay a lot of attention to what color they are, no matter where you are, you know. No matter what it's like when you go outside.
You're listening to Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. My guest is Mary Helen Stefaniak. We're talking about her new novel, The Caliphs of Baghdad, Georgia. And if you'd like to join our conversation, you can give us a call at 866-780-9100. You can also tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Maybe you also grew up in a bicultural family and you have some experience with the South and Southern culture and Southern segregation, or Northern segregation for that matter. Join our conversation, 866-780-9100. Tweet us at IPR Talk or send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. You seem to have a real affection for this Southern culture, and you've lived in the North most of your life. You live in Iowa City. You split your time in Omaha. What is it about the South that draws you in?
Well, I think it's mostly because there are people I love, you know, who live there. It's probably the number one reason. It's also even today, because I do visit pretty regularly. It is a place. It is a place somewhat apart from other places I've been. Well, I guess I'm mostly from the Midwest, so I guess it's a place apart from the Midwest. It's a place where, in my experience, and again, see, you know, I'm usually, but I'm on vacation when I go there visiting people that, you know, that I care about, or taking my mother to visit her sister. And so it always seems as though people have time to have a little more time to talk to each other, you know, or to, whereas, again, it might partly just be a function of what I'm doing when I'm in the Midwest working my head off, and what I'm doing when I'm there. But it's interesting that a colleague of mine, even though I grew up in the Midwest, you know, in Milwaukee, a colleague of mine at Creighton commented to me once. She had spent some time. She was actually from the Congo, but she had spent some time in school and teaching in Alabama. So she had an acquaintance, and she herself is black, and she had an acquaintance with the South as a result. And she commented to me that she knew right away that I was there was something Southern about me, and it was because of that, because I seemed to. I don't know. I seem to be a little more relaxed, or I seem to always have a couple of minutes to talk. Maybe I'm just, you know, more like Forrest than I should be, but I'm just too sociable. But I do manage to get some things done, nevertheless, as do, you know, people who live in the South.
How much research did you put into creating this town in Georgia in 1938? Because there are many connections that you draw within the novel between real places and stories that span the globe, really. How much effort did you put into creating this place in the midst of that web?
Oh, well, you know, some of my, since I was starting with a period when my mother was a child in Georgia, I had a lot of informants that I could, you know, call up on the phone, my mom, my Aunt Sissy, and others. And when I would visit, I'd demand, you know, tours of places where my mother had lived, and to kind of get a sense and get all the stories about places that might be gone now, but I could kind of get the picture. I did have to do a lot of research into Miss Spivey and her travels, because Miss Spivey, as I read at the beginning, you know, is a person who has traveled widely, and particularly in the Middle East, and particularly she had a sojourn in Baghdad that is part of the reason why she resolves to revive the town festival as the Baghdad Bazaar. But Miss Spivey's the connection with Baghdad really was the thing that required a great deal of research. That was something kind of strange. It seemed like the obvious choice to make use of the Georgia environment that I had so many connections to. But I had also resolved to bring Baghdad into it somehow or another, and I didn't really know initially how to do that. So I gave Miss Spivey this, you know, history and this attachment. First of all, she just had a big attachment to the Arabian Nights. The Stories of the Arabian Nights has a big 10-volume set. And then having traveled to Baghdad with Dr. Janet Miller, she is all the more enamored of it. And it was in doing that research, I started reading about Baghdad. I really had no idea initially how I would connect Baghdad. I did have the title. I had the title, The Caliphs of Baghdad, Georgia, and I really didn't know, well, where was Baghdad going to come into it? And so I started reading about Baghdad, and I found this wonderful book called The Camel Bells of Baghdad by the real Dr. Janet Miller, who was a real person, a physician from Nashville, Tennessee, and she was just a woman ahead of her time. She was a doctor without borders. You know, she traveled around the world. And this wonderful book, which is really kind of a travelogue, The Camels of Baghdad, Georgia, is what gave me the idea to make Miss Spivey, my school teacher, at some point in her life, a traveling companion to this woman, Dr. Miller. So that was a great find. I learned a great deal about Baghdad, and the one, you know, on the banks of the Tigris in the 1920s and 30s. And so that was really the first real solid connection other than the 1001 Nights that helped me bring those two things together.
You must have felt like you won the lottery when you found that.
I did, but there was more to come. I found out more.
All right. Well, we'll talk more in a moment. I'm talking with Mary Helen Stefaniak, the author of The Caliphs of Baghdad, Georgia. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe, and today I'm here with Mary Helen Stefaniak. She's an author. She teaches at Creighton University. She also lives in Iowa City, and her latest novel is The Caliphs of Baghdad, Georgia. And Mary Helen, before the break, we were talking about the connections that you discovered as you were looking for connections between Baghdad, Iraq, and this area of Georgia that you were writing about. You mentioned that you had already resolved to make Baghdad a part of your book, that you had the title and you had a vague idea of the concept before you started researching these connections. Why did you resolve to incorporate Baghdad into your book?
Well, I came up with that idea. I was already thinking about writing a novel that, or even a group of stories that, you know, was set in Georgia. In March 2003, I got it into my head that I wanted to write a novel in which a group of Americans, and they turned out to be the Caliphs and Three-Step, had a relationship with Baghdad that was different from the relationship that was developing at that time. I guess I sort of had this I did. I thought about the Arabian Nights, and I thought about the architecture and the poetry and the storytelling of. And I guess I just kind of had this thought: well, we're bombing the cradle of civilization. Somebody has to remember that somehow. This other role, this other kind of relationship that we have with what I was calling Baghdad, but really kind of stands for a broad swath of history and culture and kind of all things Islamic and Arabian, which are all terms that can't really be used interchangeably, and yet they all sort of, you know, cluster together. So that was my resolve, and I wanted people to be able to read this book and have a different feeling about Baghdad than what we were carrying as a burden at the time.
Your school teacher, Grace Spivey, has almost an obsession with the tales of the Arabian Nights. And she has this 10-volume set with all of the stories in it, the Richard Burton official publication.
Right. Sir Richard F. Burton.
Right, right. Did you have a relationship with those books, with the Arabian Nights?
Well, not to the extent that Miss Spivey did. But it was the first connection that came to me. And I do love complicated narration. I do love stories within stories. I mean, I love the way, if you actually read the Arabian Nights, which is or parts of them. I mean, it's a big book. You start a story, like the Barber of Baghdad or something. And then within that story, somebody starts telling a story. And you, after a while, you completely forget about the Barber of Baghdad and you're in a completely, another place and time. And then that story runs along until someone in that story starts telling a story. And you just keep moving, into different places. And then eventually you come back to where you start. You started with the Barber of Baghdad, and you're a little surprised, and you think, oh yes.
But you come back with some important pieces of information.
You do. Well, you in the Arabian Nights themselves, you do, yes. But in fact, we're kind of – I do that that same kind of story within stories in the Caliphs of Baghdad, Georgia. And you do in the stories, you do come back with information about the original story that you probably couldn't have gotten any other way.
And you do lead us down a rabbit hole, sort of. Was it part of your original idea that you wanted to create that kind of a narrative that you see in the tales of the Arabian Nights?
Yes, I think so. I didn't know exactly. I didn't know exactly how I would do it, but I did want the book to somehow get to Baghdad, the one on the Tigris between the, and I thought, and there were other periods that I wanted to kind of touch on the way, and that really came from learning. I have to tell you about this discovery, because the Camel Bells of Baghdad was a wonderful thing, but I made another even more exciting discovery that helped shaped the movement, helped make solid that connection between Georgia and Baghdad. And that was there was a point I was writing. I had been happily writing away for two or three years already. And I needed a coastal island, one of Georgia's coastal islands, for purposes of the plot. And I hadn't ever been to one of them. And so my husband and I, on the next trip, the next time we went down to Georgia with my mom, we checked out Skidaway Island, which is right, near Savannah. And then we also went to Sapelo Island. And Sapelo Island is one of the more remote. It's not that it's that far away. It's off the coast of Georgia, but it was for a long time owned by the tobacco company the tobacco magnate R.J. Reynolds, and before that by an automobile manufacturer, and before that much of it was a single plantation, and you have to take a tour of Baghdad, of Sapelo, because there aren't, like tourist sites and things. There's a little town called Hog Hammock, that is populated in large part by descendants of the slaves who worked that plantation that covered most of the island. And the University of Georgia has some things there. But in any case, you have to have business there in order to visit Sapelo Island. So, but you can take a tour. They have various tours. So we took a tour, went out on the ferry, and rode around in this Bluebird bus. It's a wonderful tour. And in fact, some of the residents offer tours as well. And while we were in the visitor center, after the tour, we were looking around at, they had historical displays. It was kind of a mini museum. And my husband brought me over to one of the displays. I have to give him credit for this, because there under the glass was a facsimile of a, well, I didn't know it was a facsimile, but there was a notebook. And the pages of the notebook were written in Arabic. I mean, I can't read Arabic, but it was clearly Arabic script. And so what I came to find out was that that notebook belonged to a man named Bilali Mahomet, who was a slave and, in fact, the manager, the slave driver on the plantation that covered most of Sapelo Island. But he came originally from West Africa, and he was a literate African Muslim. I had no idea that this was the case. And then, of course, I started reading in that direction, and I found there were many literate Muslims who were among those, whether kidnapped or captured and sold in Africa, and carried over, who finished out, you know, their lives, lots of people in slavery in the South. So here I was looking for some kind of, you know, oh, the 1001 Nights, which is a nice thing, but, you know, is a reach. And then I found this doctor from Tennessee who'd been to Baghdad. And then it turned out, well, I didn't need to bring the culture to Georgia. It was already there.
I had no when in reading these stories there. You know, it's of course it's a novel, so I never knew what was real and what was your invention. But that's just an amazing find.
It certainly was. And in the novel, there's a night of storytelling that occurs in the novel after something. After the Baghdad Bazaar has taken place and something terrible has occurred and everyone is waiting to see how it will turn out. And so they do like the Arabian Nights. They tell stories. And that's the story that keeps on. Within that story, another story begins. And through that, through those stories, I imagine Bilali Mahomet's life before he was kidnapped and he was sent, you know, and sold into slavery. He was from Fouta Djallon, which is in present day Guinea, that area. So right on the, you know, right on the west, almost in West Africa, almost on the coast. And he had gone to school enough, at least, you know, by the time he was 14, probably to read the Quran, and maybe he was even being trained to be a scribe or an imam because he was learning to write as well. And then, you know, nobody knows how he was, whether he was just, you know, kidnapped off a by Europeans, or whether he was kidnapped in a, you know, war and sold. Sometimes prisoners of war were sold to slave traders. But what I do is I imagine him as a 14-year-old going from West Africa to Mecca with his father, performing the Hajj, and they have a lot of adventures. And his Bilali is a very my Bilali that I create is a very mechanically gifted person, just like Theo Boykin. And ultimately he does end up getting Bilali Mahomet, as a 14-year-old, ends up getting all the way to Baghdad because that his father has always wanted to go to Baghdad. Although they are officially on their way to Mecca, they're both planning to make this 900-mile detour to Baghdad before they get back.
One of the things that I found really interesting about your characters, and this is with regard to race relations, the young African-American characters seem to be so much wiser about the world than the young Caucasian characters. And I wonder if that's something that you found or perhaps your mother found, because these white children were in many ways shielded from the true history of the South and the reality of the day that they were living in, whereas the young black characters couldn't be.
Well, I think that's exactly the reason why the young black characters have to grow up faster and have to be more aware of sort of who's who and who has the power and what path they need to walk to stay safe. So I think that they have to know.
This is, of course, the 50th anniversary of To Kill a Mockingbird by Harper Lee, which is another book that took us to a small town in the South where we learned a great deal about race relations. Is Harper Lee an inspiration for you?
Oh, well, actually, it's one review called the book To Kill a Mockingbird Meets the Arabian Nights. Well, that book in particular is important in, it was important to me. It was one of my favorite books. In this novel, in The Caliphs of Baghdad, Georgia, I do actually kind of, what I'm doing, if I'm in a conversation with To Kill a Mockingbird or if I'm being a little uppity and making an argument with it. But I kind of went out of my way to make the lawyer in Three Step, whereas the lawyer, you know, in To Kill, the Atticus Finch is the moral center of To Kill a Mockingbird. But in Three Step, the lawyer is actually the grand goblin of the Ku Klux Klan. He just happens to be the only.
He is no Atticus Finch.
He is no Atticus Finch. And then, of course, Atticus Finch is the best read wise man of Maycomb in that book. But in The Caliphs of Baghdad, Georgia, the smartest person in the county is and the best read we come to learn is Theo Boykin.
You also mentioned in one of the interviews that you've done that you feel like in a way your writing is an homage and an argument with Flannery O'Connor. And can you explain that comment?
Oh, yes. Well, and that homage and argument probably also applies to To Kill a Mockingbird. But Flannery O'Connor I have a special connection with because my mother and her sister went to high school with Flannery O'Connor. I mentioned that my mother's from the Milledgeville area, as was Flannery O'Connor. And my mother's older sister, 1 year older, graduated with Flannery in her class of, 1942, from Peabody High School on the grounds of the college there in Milledgeville. And it was a laboratory school, you know, kids who didn't have any money could go there for free. So I think I was in high school myself when I learned that, you know, this woman who had written this story in my short story book in English class went to high school with my mom.
And so that short story, I'm guessing, was Everything That Rises Must Converge. Is that the... I don't know. That's the one that everyone reads today.
Yes. Well, that one, Everything That Rises Must Converge, and A Good Man Is Hard to Find are kind of the pair that I think she's best known for, and that I think are her most incredible stories. So I mean, you have to honor her. She's an incredible, incredibly talented person whose life was cut very short by illness, and who knows what all she would have gone on to, what kind of opus as it is. Her opus is very, very impressive. But, you know, she borrowed a lot of her characters from the social class. And, you know, sometimes I imagine she saw my uncle, you know, Ebenezer walking down the road, and he became a character in one of her books or in one of her stories. So she did draw her characters from that social class, and she created a very harsh world, really, in which people don't do each other very much good. You know, that's and it's just part of her outlook on redemption, I guess would be the best way to put it. But I always felt as though my mother's family was sort of in the background in those stories, and I was thinking, well, they weren't like that, you know. they didn't treat each other the way the kind of grotesque and humorous and often violent characters in Flannery O'Connor stories do. So yeah, so it's kind of a, you know, it's a corrective in that way. I said, well, here's what, you know, the view from inside one of those very small, humble houses that Flannery O'Connor would set her stories in.
And you do seem to love your characters, even the flawed characters, the deeply flawed characters. You seem to have an affection for most of them.
Yes, I think that's true. Characters who do bad things in the book, very bad things, I do give them, I don't know if Flannery O'Connor would, but I give them a small opportunity for some kind of redemption.
Mary,
it's true.
Mary Helen, thank you so much for your time today.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Mary Helen Stefaniak is the author of The Caliphs of Baghdad, Georgia. She will be reading at Prairie Lights Bookstore in Iowa City coming up on September 27th at 7 p.m. Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese. Our executive producer is Jeff Schmidt. Production assistance today from Christina Sarnelli and technical support from Sarah McCammon in Des Moines. I'm Charity Nebbe. Tomorrow on Hort Day, fall color and the most colorful trees for your yard. This is Talk of Iowa.